Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jessica Hubbard and I will be hosting today's webinar. Thank you so much for joining us. Today, we're exploring BEE and the small business and how business owners can navigate the complex BEE landscape. We're joined by Nicolene Schoeman-Low from Schoeman Law, who will take us through some of the most important elements of BEE for the small business today. Nicolene, thank you again for joining us. And can you briefly introduce yourself and explain the work that you're doing?
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. I think this is a very misunderstood space, so I'm happy for the opportunity and for us to have this conversation. I'm the managing director of Schoeman Law Incorporated. We are based in Cape Town, South Africa, and we focus on serving the legal needs of the entrepreneur. I myself, as a practitioner, have been passionate about empowerment and about BEE since its inception when the first act was promulgated in 2003. And I actually did my master's thesis on it with a focus on cooperatives and stock funds. And was really privileged to be able to advise NEDLAG at that stage. And since then, I've been advising companies large and small about their transformation strategies, about the implementation, about scorecard optimization, and anything in between, really. So,
Brilliant. So to put it all into context, obviously navigating the local BEE landscape can be an utter minefield for many small businesses that are trying to comply with scorecard commitments while also keeping a close eye on their bottom line. So BEE done right can be a fantastic catalyst for finding new business and transforming the economy, while BEE done wrong can be an expensive mistake. So, Nicolene, as a starting point, can you take us through some of the most recent changes in the BEE sectoral codes and explain why they matter for today's SME?
Yeah. So the most significant change we saw in 2013 already, so fairly recent, I suppose, and that really changed the way in which we view the scorecard regardless of sectors in a very drastic way. So, for example, the scorecard elements prior to the amendment consisted of 7 elements. They were reduced to 5, of which 3 are the priority elements, as we call them. Those are skills development, and they are also the ownership component, which became compulsory regardless of the fact that it's also a priority element. We'll get back to that in a minute. And then we also saw a focus on enterprise and supplier development as a priority element. So those 3 became the focus areas with specific, call it targets to reach. And if those targets are not reached, you can actually be penalized by level on QSE level. So maybe just for clarity, we have 3 levels of compliance measurement: the EME or exempt micro enterprise level, 0 to 10 million in turnover; then the qualifying small enterprise or QSE level, between 10 and 50 million; and then generic is between 50 and above, rather. So we've got the 3 bands of compliance, and the 3 priority elements are really significant in the QSE space. So in terms of the EME, we've got a bit of a more relaxed compliance component, but then a little bit more in the QSE level, and then full compliance on the generic level. So those were the big changes that we saw in 2013 already. And since then, the DTI has issued a number of clarifying notices for us to understand the practical implementation of some of these codes. We've also seen some of the sector codes being changed quite drastically. One of the most noteworthy ones, particularly, I would say, being the construction sector code. They've had some significant changes. We've recently seen proposed future changes regarding some of the calculations on skills development, for example, which will be quite useful. And then we've also seen a clarification notice on verification agencies and how the standards will work henceforth. And then, of course, we've seen some investigations being conducted by the commissioner, the industry watchdog, for lack of a better phrase, and issuing some further clarifications around the concept of fronting, which was also a big amendment in 2013, a big and a very broad concept, still needed to be tested by our courts.
So for SMEs and business owners, obviously tackling all this can be very daunting. How can business owners begin to comply with these sector codes, and what steps should they be taking today, bearing in mind that SMEs don't have access to teams of lawyers and those types of experts? So what are some practical steps that SMEs can take without huge investment to remain compliant?
Well, I think step one is to determine whether or not you fall under a specific sector code. There are a number of them, and if you are active in a particular industry and your sector doesn't historically have a code is maybe in the pipeline, then you should be consulted through the process, or there should be a public participation process. So some of the sectors that have had long-standing sector codes are mining, tourism, the construction industry, as I've mentioned, and the advertising and marketing space is a recent addition, ICT, or information communication technology, also a long-standing participant. I believe the legal profession is currently looking at one of their own, and quite recently the financial services sector were also added with their own sector code. So first step is to determine if you fall under a particular sector code, and if you do, then to navigate some of the material on the DTI's website is quite user-friendly and really explains quite well what you should be looking at. Then there's also quite a bit of information available on the internet, but again, be very careful. You don't always know what is reliable and what is not. We, for one, publish quite widely on the topic regularly. So, and all of that is freely available to any participant. So I think if you do stumble on some information on the internet, just make sure that it comes from someone who is a professional, who is an expert in the field. I say it with care, be careful of consultants. You don't always know which qualifications they hold to render the advice. So rather choose someone with a professional affiliation. At least there's a mechanism to keep them accountable to rendering good advice, such as attorneys and accountants, etc. So that would be the first step, determining the sector, if applicable, then equipping yourself with some basic knowledge, then to consult with someone. So if your business is still below the 10 million threshold, then you can download the affidavit that the DTI published in terms of the new rules, which you will either, if you are 0% black owned, then you'll be a level 4 contributor. So you'll just complete the affidavit correctly, sign it in front of a commissioner of oaths, and that's what you will use in your tender or RFQ or quoting processes if any of your suppliers or potential suppliers want to see a BE certificate. Similarly, if you're 51% black owned, then you're a level 2 automatically and 100% level 1. So those are relaxed, call it compliance measures, available to small businesses so that they do not have to expend the money of going through an expensive and time-consuming verification process. And that's available to everyone under the 10 million threshold. The minute you exceed the 10 million threshold, though, then it becomes much more of a planned process. So small businesses that are currently under the threshold shouldn't shouldn't wait too long in order to empower themselves to find out what the requirements are for the next level, so that you can plan and you can put measures in place and you can find out how it works, so that when you exceed the 10 million threshold amount, that you are ready with all the paperwork in the right places, etc. So it's not something you can get done overnight, and really shouldn't be something you get done overnight. It should be something that fits in authentically with your business strategy, and that you implement as you would have any other business process in the process of scaling.
Yes. Okay. Brilliant. So you touched on BEE consultants and verification agencies. I'd just like to go a bit further into this topic. What should SMEs and business owners understand about working with consultants and with verification agencies?
I always like to compare it to the financial industry and say, your consultant is like your bookkeeper. It's the person who makes sure that there are certain operational processes in place, that they align with a certain recognized standard, and they are implemented. Your verification agent is more like your auditor. So I know there are organizations where the consultancy and the verification takes place under the same umbrella. There's no rule against it, but of course, I'm sure if we look at governance perspectives, for example, if we go back to our comparison of saying a verification agent is similar to an auditor, then it follows naturally that it shouldn't be the same place or under the same umbrella. Why? Because there's a conflict of interest. Obviously, if it's under the same umbrella, then there isn't the necessary objectivity that you would need in order to get a realistic, unbiased certificate issued. So personally, I feel that there actually should be a rule against consultants also being verification agencies.
Okay.
Be that as it may, there is no current rule against it. So your verification agent is really the one that will be issuing your certificate and checking that all your T's are crossed and I's are checked. So it just naturally follows it shouldn't be the same person. A, would you really see all your own mistakes in error or otherwise? And there's more room for improvement if it's separate. It adds more value.
Okay. I'd like to just change track for a moment and talk about the opportunities within BEE, again, for the small enterprise. So is there a way or a smart strategy which can see a small business owner, an SME, turning BEE spend into a source of new business for the enterprise?
Yes, and I would like to take a little bit of time in answering this question, because I think many South African businesses really miss this concept very, very much so. Many South Africans see this as yet another set of regulations that we need to comply with, more expenses, more red tape, more expenses. No one has really sat critically and assessed the tangible advantages that a authentic strategy can really have for any business. So by saying all of this, firstly, if you're doing business with larger corporates or even larger other SMEs that are beyond the startup phase, that are all on the same journey, wanting to ensure that they've got representative and transformed workplaces and ownership structures in their businesses, that is imperative for them to do business with like-minded businesses or individuals. So for us, for example, it's quite important that our suppliers are in the same mind when it comes to this. So it's actually one of our onboarding questions when we onboard a new supplier. And you'll find the longer the regulations are around and the more of us are really taking this seriously as a business imperative, the hotter it will become for anyone who sees this as a checkbox exercise. So firstly, the minute you are growing and you are starting to do business with larger businesses, if you don't have this in place, you've reached your glass ceiling and it may actually cause the demise of your business. In simple terms, no one will want to do business with you any longer. Similarly, if you embrace this and you have your first tier, second tier, third tier plan, particularly maybe in the context of a family business or a business that has started and needs to really look at expansion, that you look at it holistically and you consider this. And this can really unlock great opportunities. We've seen government, treasury, issuing directives just a few months ago saying certain opportunities will be reserved for level ones and level twos. So we're going to issue tenders and RFQs with that as a prerequisite. So don't, if you have a level lower than that, you're not eligible even to try and tender. The 80-20 rule being 80% on price and 20% on BE level doesn't apply in a context of a tender that is exclusively marked to be for level ones and twos. So we're seeing that even government is placing further pressure on the situation by saying certain opportunities are reserved. So one needs to know all these things. Then lastly, if you look at your spend, if you're a QSE and you're not going through the affidavit process I explained a short while ago, then you have to go through the verification process. And there are five elements, as I said earlier, of which three are priority elements. Your ownership component is compulsory. So that leaves you with two priority elements, one of which you need to choose. So either skills development or supplier enterprise development. Whichever you choose, that is the four elements that you'll be complying with. And there are certain targets set for all of those, certain paper records, call it a portfolio of evidence that you have to build up over the calendar year in order to submit this to your verification agent. And that's what they use to work out your score. So the point is all the expenses that you incur, if you treat them correctly in your books, in your accounts, some of these expenses can actually be processed as a normal business expense, which is tax deductible. So if you're looking at, for example, sponsoring a Black-owned business, maybe one of your suppliers under your enterprise development program, depending on what you'll be doing for those beneficiaries or that particular business, you can actually deduct it as a income generating expense in your, like you with your rental and stationery and all these other things we need in our business. And that's tax deductible. If you're expending a capital amount, there could also be benefits to treating that correctly. Also, if you look at the other elements, you've got a charitable element, the corporate social investment one, the CSI element. It doesn't count many points, but again, if you're smart about it, you can pick a charity that has a PBO reference, and that's a special designation that you get through SARS, meaning not only do you get your BE points, but you actually get a tax deduction if you donate money to them. So by multi-purposing and making it whole with your business strategy and not just making it a box you need to tick and some more red tape, this is actually could be quite beneficial on a number of fronts, not only to physically grow your footprint, but also in deducting your expenses correctly and spending your money wisely.
Absolutely. So much to consider there for business owners. So Nicolene, I'd just like to move on to some of the pre-submitted questions for today's discussion. You've already gone into this, but I'd just like to clarify again. One question was, what is the difference between a BE consultant and a BE verification agency?
Okay, so succinctly, a verification agency is the person who will be issuing your certificate. They'll be looking at all the paperwork that you've collected to prove your efforts in terms of the scorecard. they'll allocate points on this on the BE scorecard for you, and they will once you are done, they'll issue the certificate for a specific period of time. Then your consultants. Your consultants are people that advise on mechanisms to comply. So they would look at your strategy, look at some of your documents, and put some of the documents that are not in place in place. So often the two do work together, but as I said, it's not advisable for it to be under the same umbrella. There could be, for example, if a less than desirable certificate was issued, one could look into the detail as to what was missing, and the consultant could then assist in implementing something that basically fills the gap so that a better point score is facilitated in the next run. So two very distinct roles, advisory, that's the consultant, and then the certificate issuing, which is the verification agent.
Okay, so another key question related to this is, do I have any recourse against a BEE consultant whose advice was not accepted by my verification agency?
Sorry, you just broke up a little. Could you repeat
the
that,
question
please?
Was, do I have any recourse against a BEE consultant whose advice was not accepted by my verification agency?
That's always a bit of a tricky situation. Why? Because let's go back to who are these consultants. Some of these consultants do not hold any qualification to call themselves experts in the field. I know of a number of well-known consultancies, and of course we're not mentioning any names, that are that do not have any legal background in order to understand the regulations and their complexity, because they are quite complex. Secondly, we don't have a general metric or qualification standard in South Africa to say, at least if you've got this diploma or so on, then you can be a BEE consultant. My apologies. We don't have any of that. So what we are seeing is that people with HR backgrounds, general business backgrounds, sometimes attorneys that leave the profession and become non-practicing attorneys for whatever reason, and sometimes even accountants become consultants. So the problem is we sit with an unregulated space in a very specialized segment of regulation. So that's a really big problem, is that we sit with this unregulated industry. So firstly, if you're unlucky and you've chosen a consultant who doesn't have the necessary experience or qualification, the ultimate result is often a really bad structure or advice that isn't recognized by the verification agent. Your only recourse is, of course, to sue the consultant, but often, to be frank, these guys do not have the money to pay for any claim that you institute. So you ultimately may be successful in your court action against them, just to find out that they don't have money to pay you any damages. Or they close up their business and they just open under a different name. These things unfortunately do happen. So it's best to keep it in a professional space where the person you're working with is registered with a professional body. For us, it's the Legal Practice Council. So if we render poor advice, then we need to account for that. We need to take responsibility for that. And there's a whole disciplinary process that our body prescribes that you can be subjected to if you make yourself guilty of that. So at least the members of the public have recourse if that happens to them at the hand of a practicing attorney.
Okay, so it seems like for SMEs or for any business really today, it's an area where they have to really do some proper due diligence and research before just going with somebody or some agency who gives themselves that BEE label.
Yeah, so I think members of the public should be really, really careful who they contract with. And you can always try it at the very least and get an attorney to write them a letter saying, I was unhappy with the service for these reasons. I would like at least my spend with you back. And maybe they'll do the right thing and they'll reimburse you.
Okay. So I'd like to move on to the next question. Is the Youth Employment Service incentive a good one for SMEs?
The Yes campaign.
The Yes campaign.
Yes. I you can just hear the excitement in my voice. I think the Yes campaign is one of the best additions since we've seen the regulations being amended. It is such a valuable golden nugget that few businesses actually know about. You can actually up a level if you employ under 35s. We, for one, are quite lucky. We pretty much 85% of our staff complement fits the profile. So it's really useful. And you can be so creative with the Yes campaign in terms of opportunities you create of mentorship, coaching, skills development programs, career path development. There are so many powerful things you can actually do through that. So it's absolutely crucial, and I think it's a social imperative for each employer in South Africa to try and employ as many young people as we possibly can.
Brilliant. So a full thumbs up for the Youth Employment Service campaign. I'd just like to invite our participants at this point to submit any questions online that they have for Nicolien. So just type it up in the Q&A section and we'll try to answer those for you. And we'll move on to our next pre-submitted question, which is, we are considering using the Inyosi funds as a way to manage our EDSD funds. Is this something you would recommend?
There are actually quite a number of funds out there these days. My experience is that they are quite expensive. I haven't looked at this one particularly. I am aware of its existence, but I haven't looked at the costs associated with it. I know there are a number of other funds that have been around for quite a few years. They are really, really powerful. But as I say, they seem to be a bit out of reach for a small business in terms of the cost associated. But again, as a small business, you need to weigh up the cost versus the time spent. And ED, or enterprise development, is all about capacitating another small business, essentially paying it forward. And that is very time consuming if you take that seriously. So for us, purely because we find real joy in it, we select a number of businesses that can either be our clients or our suppliers that have budgetary constraints or need certain aspects to capacitate their business. We select them through a process once a year, and then we actually map out a certain project plan with milestones to capacitation. And a lot of times that involves a lot of mentoring and time spent over and above the capital outlay. So, which also, of course, if in a service-based business like ours, has a cost element to it. So at the end of the day, it's a personal decision. Either pay the money and the price tag to invest in a fund of that nature, or if you have the capacity and the time to spend to do it and manage it yourself, it's important to manage the ultimate outcome that you achieve through your efforts of capacitation, and that is quite time consuming. So if you don't have the time, then maybe it's worth the extra spend by investing in a fund like that.
Yes, certainly something to keep in mind, especially given that many business owners and managers are pretty time poor in today's environment. Nicolien, we've had no questions submitted online. Is there anything else you'd like to touch on, which we maybe haven't explored during today's discussion, specifically relating to BEE and the small business in South Africa?
I think it's a contentious point, and it really need not be the topic as a whole. It's really such a, if I've seen so many businesses implement measures that have become so powerful, not only in transforming their own operations and their ownership structures and, you know, being more representative of our country and where you operate. I mean, no business can really see themselves as an island within the greater society and community that we operate in. I think it's a social imperative for us to see this as a strategy as, and not as a tick box exercise. So it's really powerful. And for us at Schoeman Law, this is really a focus area. So we publish a lot of material. I invite any attendees or their networks to have a look at our website. We publish articles when any edits or updates happen regularly. It's freely accessible. We've got a number of YouTube videos actually on the topic also. And other than that, it's my focus area and my passion in the firm. So I also publish quite widely in mainstream and other publications. And I think just watch this space and keep up to date as far as you possibly can and align it with your business's strategic plans for the next year, 2 year, 5 years. It's not possible to implement a sustainable transformation strategy. Often we get a request to do it in a week or two. That's quite scary that people even think that you can do that. It's things that really need proper consideration and planning. It is quite expensive to comply if you don't plan it properly, if you don't integrate it, if you're not smart about where you spend your money, how you spend your money, how you document. And that's where a consultant that is professionally registered, such as ourselves, that's where we really add value. We look at it holistically. We look at where you are in your journey. We don't expect you to implement something that is maybe a little too complex for where you are in your journey right now. We like to have a sound foundation and then for you to build on that foundation. And of course, for transformed businesses to market that and to really ensure that their paperwork is ready so that people know, oh, I can support this business. They can fill the gap which my current supplier can't because they've got the rating that my current supplier doesn't have. So it's as important to the transformed business to ensure that you communicate it and you leverage that status well enough so that you can ultimately also benefit from it.
Absolutely. Nicolene, thank you so much for joining us today. It's such an important topic right now, and there's obviously lots more we could speak about, but I think we'll end it there for now.
Thank you so much. If anyone has any other questions, feel free to make contact with me. Details are on our website at www.schoemanlaw.co.za.
Brilliant. And on our side, a link to the playback facility will be sent to all participants, but you can also get in touch with us if you do not receive the link and if you have any more questions on the topic. Thank you again, everyone, for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you again soon.